All right. If I remember right, we did not finish Psalm 7, and so we'll continue to look at that. Remember, we're dealing with probably, we piece together certain components of this, probably early in the record of David's life. He is not king yet, almost certainly. He's probably on the run from Saul. So we're dealing with the 1 Samuel section of his life. And remember that David had, when you're king, you can do things. When you're not king, you don't have the authority, the God-given authority to do it. One of the things that make me glad I'm not a governor or a president or something like that, is you have the authority, and it's a God-given authority, of life and death in a lot of people's situations. You deal with the military, you deal with whether or not you can pardon somebody that's on death row. I mean, these are things that are tossed your way. And as an absolute monarch in this day, if you committed murder, that was capital punishment. You're dealing with constant wars. Diplomacy was not a fine-tuned science at this time. And usually squabbles resulted in the taking up of arms with the death of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. You wonder why. Have you ever seen one of those graphs of world population? How for centuries it was almost flat, slightly rising. And then it wasn't until the 19th century and then into the 20th century that just spiked. And the reason for that is twofold. One, or it's threefold. One is control over a lot of epidemic diseases. One is, we got enough food to feed people. And three, we don't have wars, generally, that kill hundreds of thousands and millions of people anymore. We really don't. Wars that we have today kill tens of thousands, occasionally hundreds of thousands. But we don't have stuff. We haven't had wars that have killed millions of people since World War II. Unless you include the, you know, Mao's genocide and that kind of thing. Which was in-house, I suppose. But you don't have war like they used to. Now, we're going to have it. Scripturally, it indicates that that's going to be the case. We're going to have stuff that's unprecedented as far as world history is concerned. But squabbles were arms. They'd get together, and you would see a lot of people die. And so David, as a king, would have that to deal with. But here he doesn't. And especially if you have the likes of Saul, who is persecuting him. Saul's the king. Saul is God's anointed. David could not and would not do anything to Saul. We saw he had two occasions where he had opportunity and would not take it because it would be wrong for him to do so. God had not given him the authority to do that. Saul, on the other hand, because he is the king, does have that authority. And so David, by default, has to rely on God's intervention. I find that interesting that we so often want to take things into our own hands, or I can handle this, or I can do this, and we only go to God for the things that are beyond our ability to deal with. God, I want you to take care of this because I'm too busy doing this, or I can't do this, and I can't deal with this. This is beyond my scope to cope with. We ask for healing. We ask for God's intervention in the hearts and lives of people. We ask for God's intervention on the international scene and all different kinds of other things. But if it involves I need a car. I need to make home repairs. I need to whatever. We're going to work hard and we're going to make that happen. And we often don't pray about it. I remember we used to have somebody here at church that had their own business. And I used to pray. I said, you know, I'm praying for the Lord to prosper your business. He says, no, I never pray for that. I said, why not? You ought to. Nah, I just don't think that's right. Well, I said, well, I'm going to pray anyway. Because you have a biblical responsibility to support your family and to care for your family and to deal with these things. And therefore, I pray that the Lord would prosper your business. Pray for you two guys, Lord, prosper your businesses. And not just, you know, bless so-and-so and bless so-and-so. I deal with a few specifics. And so we have a tendency to pray for the things that are beyond our control, but not for the things that we actually have a hand in. And we need to do that, too, because we can screw it up royally. We really can. God, help me. Help me in my preaching. Help me not to say anything stupid. Help me not to stumble over my words. May I not be a distraction from the message. And I can't rely on myself. Matter of fact, if I think about it, how in the world can I get up there and just go on for 40 minutes? If I think about that, I get scared. Because I don't know how it happens. It just happens. Because God is doing that. And so we deal with the mundane things, but things that we have a hand in, we have a tendency to not pray about and not consider that we need God's help in these things, unless it's above and beyond the norm. But things that we deal with on a routine basis, we have a tendency not to pray for. So, David, remember, we saw that, this is that bold thing we talked about last time. If I am guilty, David says, if I have done wrong, then go ahead and let justice come. If I'm out of line, then God deal with me. And that's actually something we probably ought to pray. Not necessarily that God's justice, but that God would make it known to us and that we would have a yielded and broken heart in that regard. I mentioned last time, one of the things I pray for on Saturday nights regarding preachers in particular, is that the Lord would make known to us the sin in our lives that we're unaware of. That we have habits and patterns of thinking and just things that we do that we are unaware are a stumbling block. We're unaware that it causes us to have a pattern of thinking or something that's not right. It's out of line. And we need to be aware of those things. Make known to me the things in my life that are not in accord with what you would have. And Lord, give me the grace to deal with them, because sometimes these things are so deeply entrenched that that's why we're unaware of them. It's so much part of our routine that we just kind of brush it off rather than thinking, is this wrong? Is this wrong? So, now starting in verse 6, David prays for vindication. Now, this is the thing that's off his plate. This is the thing that is beyond his control. If he is fleeing from Saul, there's nothing he can do about it except stay on the run and stay out of Saul's reach. Which, if you read 1 Samuel, that's what he was doing. But we also see a number of times where David was, I mean, that close to getting caught. I mean, and God intervened. I mean, remember, I talked the pincer movement. And David and his men are right there, and all of a sudden a messenger comes, the Philistines have invaded the land, you gotta come. Off they go. And he's delivered at the last minute by the providence of God. So he says there in verse 6, arise, O Lord, in thine anger. We could say in your justice. God is not angry just because somebody, you know, did something to irritate him. The issue is God operates on a level of justice. Arise, O Lord, in thine anger. Lift up thyself because of the rage of mine enemies. And awake from me to the judgment, the justice that thou hast commanded. God, I am doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I am in the place of your appointment, striving to do what you have called me to do. And I've got these folks over here that are attacking me, that are maligning me, that are slandering me, that are trying to do everything they can to undermine what I am doing. And I'm striving to please and honor you. Now, we have to be careful, very careful. I've seen this, where we develop a self-righteous attitude in that regard. I'm right and you're wrong and God's going to get you. And we need to make sure that we don't have that kind of an attitude, because what's not at stake is us. We need to step out of the picture and look at the scenario this is very hard to do. Well nigh impossible to do. But step out of the picture and look at how God is dealing with a set of circumstances. We can look at this in others, and especially if we're just familiar with the situation and don't have a vested emotional interest in something, we can have some objectivity. But when we're in it, it's very, very difficult. But David evidently had this ability in this particular situation to know that this was, that he was in the right and the enemy was in the wrong. So God, deal with those who are opposing what I'm trying to do. Yes.
It's almost like that verse is like, see God as omnipresent. It's almost like he's, you know, sleeping or whatever here. Wake up. You know, look what's happening.
You see this in the Psalms a lot.
Yeah,
and I think part of it has to do, this lets you know that David is a lot like us. Because sometimes when we look at all these disasters going on and all these hardships that we're doing and we get hit with this, and then about the time we finally recoup, we get hit again. And sometimes it's 3, 4, 5, 6 of these in a row, and we're just reeling and say, God, where are you? I need you. Where are you? Well, he's here all along. But sometimes we don't. And this is why we need to be very, very careful that we don't lapse into a charismatic mentality of, I have to feel something. I have to sense something. I have to have some sort of a feeling of God's presence. Now, God may give that. But there are no guarantees on that. And what we have to do is take God at his word. And when we see these difficulties and these trials and these catastrophes sometimes going on, God is just, and God will always do what's right. And remember, we are locked in time, and we don't know tomorrow. And we don't see how God is going to... I mean, the common example, Joseph, sold into slavery. God! And then he gets sold in, and then once he's a slave, he's doing the best he can, and then he's slandered, and he ends up in jail. God! And he's in jail for a long time, and he helps somebody out, and he says, now please remember, because you have access to the Pharaoh, and please help. And he says, but he forgot. And so another couple of years go on. He says, he gets sold into Egypt at the age of 17. He is 30 years old when he stands before Pharaoh. 13 years he's been putting up with this. You would think he would be in despair in his situation. And yet God does, and there he is. Because what he went through was training for that position in a lot of ways. I think that as you look at him as a teenager, I think he needed a little humbling, perhaps, a little sympathy. You know, we often go through trials. It's not the route we would take, but it's the route we need to get us from point A to point B to make us usable for the death. I should have brought it with me. When we were cleaning out Virginia's apartment, and she had downsized over the years, so she really didn't have very much. But the family, other than taking a few older family Bibles and stuff, or a few of her older Bibles, I took all the books. And next week, I will have a box of books for you folks to go through if you want something. That lady was a student of the Word, I'll tell you what. And she had the most immaculate, you guys have seen this, the most immaculate handwriting. It's just amazing. You have no trouble reading Virginia's handwriting unless the pencil is real light, as far as the, just amazing, especially compared to mine. But you can read her hand. But all the notes she wrote, just the amazing things, that God doesn't take somebody and get them fully equipped and then plop them into a job very often. What God does is he puts them into a job, and then the job and the person grow together. And David is experiencing the same kind of situation as Joseph. Now, when Joseph's all done, he says, you meant this for evil, God meant it for good. David doesn't necessarily come out and say that, but we can see that it's the same. David's going through action for those who are there later on. When you have gotten through it and you're on the other side and you see somebody else going through this, you're the person that can help them. You're the person that can, then it can encourage them and let them know that the grace of God is sufficient to deal with things like this. And so here he is, and he's asking God to intervene on his behalf. Verse 7, so shall the congregation of the people compass thee about. For their sakes, therefore, return thou on high. Again, not exactly sure of the setting here, but it's not just David that's dealing with this. There's other people around him. It might be his group of, now remember, he had 600 men, but these men had families. So David's responsible for several thousand people, probably. And he wants God to be exalted. He doesn't want to pat himself on the back regarding the circumstances. He wants to make sure that God gets the glory. Draw your people to yourself. Make yourself known to them. Verse 8, the Lord shall judge the people. He does now. Sometimes we wonder, when is the sentence going to fall? God is gracious. We want the bad guys to get it right now. Again, this gets back to the whole concept of salvation. We want the bad guys to get it now. But God is long-suffering, and God is gracious. And he's giving people opportunity to repent, and he's giving opportunity for people to resolve the wickedness. And we want them to get theirs now. But again, if the tables were turned, we want God to be long-suffering with us. And we can look back and see how God has been long-suffering with us. But when it's somebody else, we want them we want them to get theirs. So the Lord shall judge the people. And then he says, again, this is, let's just read it. Judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness, according to mine integrity that is in me. David is convinced, justly so, evidently, that he is in the right in this situation. When we are in conflict with somebody else, we have a tendency to always blame the other. We grew up doing that, especially if you had siblings. We always blame the other. We always blame the other. We always blame the other. And we very seldom consider, well, was I in part to blame for this? Nah, it was their fault. I know it. I know it. They did this, and they did this, and they did this, and they did this. Now, having mediated a few conflicts over the years, the person who has met with me before I met with the other person, and they've told me all this, and then I meet with the other person, oh, I hadn't heard that. Oh, I hadn't heard that. Oh, I hadn't heard that. Now, I'm not going to say that, but that's what's going on in here. And so when you get them together, I've got two sets of facts, and you know we'll try to make things work. David, judge me, O Lord. I'm striving to do what's right. We see other places, make known to me the sin in my own heart. But I'm striving to do what is right. Which, with that attitude, if God does make it known to you, I think that strongly implies that you're going to be doing something about it. I'll be doing something about it once it's known to me. So, verse 9, oh, let the wickedness of the wicked come to an end, but establish the just. God will do that. That is God's justice. Ultimately, that is what is going to happen. For the righteous God trieth the hearts and the reins. We talked about that last time, that reins are the kidneys and that the seat of, I think we talked about that in the Sunday, in the evening service, that the seat of the emotions in ancient times was not considered so much the heart, and of course we know it's not really the heart anyway, that's just a muscle that moves your blood around. But they thought in ancient times it was the kidneys. So when you read reins, you know, you have your renal system, that's your kidneys. And so reins is an old word for kidneys. If you have a newer translation, they just sort of morph it into heart because that's how we understand it. Same concept. So, God tries the hearts and the reins. My defense is of God, which saveth the upright in heart. Ultimately, God will vindicate. Now, do we have martyrs? Yes, we do. Do we have believers even today that are languishing in prison? Yes, we do. Do we have believers in a lot of places in the world where their houses are burned and their property confiscated and they are thrown into prison or they are driven out of their territory? Yes, we do have those things. Do we have people beaten bloody? Yes, we do have all those things. And these are God's people who are endeavoring to please him. And yet they endure these things. But ultimately, God's justice will be vindicated. My defense is of God, which saveth the upright in heart. God judgeth the righteous, and but God is angry with the wicked every day. Unless there is forgiveness of sins, unless there is redemption, lost people are always under a death sentence, just awaiting for it to be carried out. Now think about that. The wages of sin is death. And apart from redemption, apart from forgiveness that comes only through Christ, we have no hope of salvation. And every human being is under a death sentence. We are all on death row unless we've been redeemed. And the world is on death row and they're oblivious to it. But the sentence will be carried out unless they see their need of a Savior and receive the the redemption that is offered. So when it says the wages of sin is death, that's the idea that in the day you eat, you shall surely die. We're under death sentence. We are on death row just awaiting the inevitable, unless God, the governor, issues us a pardon and we take it. So God is angry with the wicked every day, every day. If he turn not, he will whet his sword. He hath bent his bow and made it ready. God is, remember we've seen this in the evening services with Isaiah and dealing with the Assyrians, how we went down this list of the nations. We're just finishing that up. This list of nations that are under God's judgment, and God uses the Assyrians as his tool of judgment. And then when he's done with the Assyrians, then the Assyrians, for their own wickedness, will also be taken. But God uses other nations as tools of judgment for nations. Nation against nation. Behold, he travaileth with iniquity. Verse 14. He hath conceived mischief. He hath brought forth falsehood. He's dealing with the idea of almost like a childbirth scenario here. This is the thinking of the wicked. They contemplate their things. They have their schemes, their plans, and they bring these things to pass, and they brought forth falsehood and lies and so forth. But here's what happens. Verse 15. He made a pit and digged it like a tiger trap. He made a pit and he digged it, but he's fallen into the ditch which he's made. He's fallen into his own trap. His mischief shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate, his own head. Now, we may not see that in the here and now. We see time and time again, and you see this mentioned in the scripture, how the wicked prosper, and how his children grow up and they die in peace. And how is this right? Well, if God is just, if God is just, and he is, this demands that there's a hereafter. If God's justice is to prevail, if God is going to be equitable, then there must be a hereafter. Otherwise, how in the world do you deal with the prosperity and the happiness and the contentment and everything of the wicked, and they live their lives, and then they die in peace? Okay. Justice has to prevail. And that demands a hereafter. Verse 17. I will praise the Lord according to his righteousness, not mine, but his righteousness, and will sing praise to the name of Lord Most High. He is worthy. He is the one that brings it all to pass. He is in control. He is the sovereign. And we look at our circumstances, and sometimes we're overwhelmed and all that, but God is in charge, and God will bring it all to pass. The source of our thanksgiving and rejoicing.